All in all, we could say that they are the epitome, as better say, or the examples of the perfect human beings available on Earth on that time.
So we see, explaining these points, yes, and these elements and these factors reminded me of something. Yes. Once, I remember a person came here and visited Ayatollah Bahjat.
Uh-huh.
When he visited Ayatollah Bajat, he came and was speaking about this beautiful and sweet exposure that he had with, yes, the late Ayatollah. He said that, oh, this was Ayatollah himself, so how is Imam, alayhi salam? I mean, when we are talking about these people, yes, about those special companions of Imam, so how the Imam himself is, how beautiful he himself is, right?
Yes.
So if this is the companion, and if we can at least imagine how the Imam would be, mm-hmm, so how will be the Allah himself?
Mm-hmm.
How beautiful the Allah, yes, himself would be towards his creatures and his servants.
So their interaction with the people will be full of respect, politeness, courtesy, isn't it?
Definitely.
That's right. With good language, you know, soft language, they are soft-hearted.
Yeah.
They are good to the people, kind to all the people. Okay, that's right.
All right, Brother Alavyan, you very beautifully in this program enumerated some of the physical and spiritual features of the companions of Imam As. Of course, each of these features has to be explained and elaborated on. Inshallah, we'll shift them into the upcoming sessions of the program. It was very kind of you, Brother
Alavyan.
Thank you.
It was a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Last Savior. As promised, we will continue our discussion regarding the spiritual features of Imam As. What are they, and what elaboration we can give on each of these different traits and characteristics. For more information, you can visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you. Afiya man.
Stream.
Without preamble, American movements regarding the ceasefire and the exchange of prisoners in the Gaza Strip have resumed, suggesting the possibility of a breakthrough soon, especially as the head of the Mossad, David Bernier, headed to Qatar last week to meet with the American, Egyptian, and Qatari mediators. This comes amidst leaks attributed to Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about immense American pressure being exerted on the mediators to achieve a breakthrough, while the Palestinian resistance Hamas has not issued any official statement regarding the resumption of negotiations. When Bernier returned to Zionist Israel from Doha last Tuesday after hours of arriving there, where he held indirect negotiations with a Hamas delegation mediated by Egypt and Qatar in the absence of the American delegation, Israeli media reflected the failure of those negotiations. However, this time Bernier met in Doha with the director of the CIA, William Burns, and the Qatari Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, and the head of the Egyptian intelligence Abbas Kamel. On the eve of his departure, Netanyahu met with Bernier at a time when the Israeli entity Channel 12 spoke of immense American pressure on the mediators to start moving quickly, adding that members of the war cabinet, Yoav Gallant, Benny Gantz, and Gadi Eisenkot, heard about the Mossad chief's departure to Doha from the media, indicating that Netanyahu monopolizes the management of the negotiation file, which is more extreme than the other members of the cabinet, which may limit optimism. Now, the level of U.S. pressure on Zionist Israel is reflected in Blinken's request to participate in two meetings with the Israeli Entity War Cabinet and the Ministerial Committee for National Security, which were scheduled to take place last Thursday and were suddenly postponed. Additionally, Blinken's visit included a meeting with ministers from a number of Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Jordan, and the Secretary General of the Executive Committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Hossein Sheikh. It has become known that when these ministers attend a meeting, discussions about the day after the Gaza war are on the agenda, in which they are intended to participate in terms of arrangement and funding to ensure first and foremost Zionist Israel's interests. What is clear from all of this is that there is intense and pressing American movement in an attempt to reach arrangements, not only linked to the risks events in the Middle East pose to U.S. interests, but also reflecting on President Joe Biden's performance in the upcoming U.S. presidential elections on the 5th of next November. It's difficult to imagine reaching election day amid a war that could completely change the electoral landscape, especially if Arab and Islamic origin voters and others affected by events in Gaza refrain from going to the polls on the promised day, making Biden an easy prey for his competitor, Donald Trump. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Unless sudden changes occur, it seems that the temporary truce in the Gaza Strip will take shape within a few days if the occupation entity is still showing resistance and prolonging the negotiations in an effort to limit the demands of the Hamas movement. The former will agree in the end to the ceasefire, which imposes on its occupation army weeks of relative calm. That's all a probability. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Hassan Sweidan, a strategic studies researcher, a writer for different media platforms, and the author of several studies in the field of international relations. A pleasure having you with us, Mr. Sweidan. Now, is there a real change in the American stance towards Zionist Israel, or is it just verbal pressure to try and deceive the American voters to make them vote for Biden in the upcoming elections in November? And if so, does Biden really think the American voter is that naive?
First of all, thank you for having me here. As a matter of fact, of course, there is no change regarding the American stance towards Zionist Israel. It's the real change is towards Netanyahu and Netanyahu's government, and we should be able to differentiate between the two things. The main problem Biden faces today is that he needs to pressure Netanyahu while not affecting Israel, and that's why he doesn't have a lot of tools, you know, because many people ask, why doesn't the U.S. just stop giving military support or military aid to Israel? And that's why, because Biden has needs to pressure Netanyahu without having any effect on Israel, and that's why he has only few tools to use in that situation. So we can't speak about divergence or a change in the view of Israel in the U.S. But the main problem is with Netanyahu, and that's because Netanyahu isn't applying the American strategies. Mm-hmm. There is a divergence between the two regarding how to finish or how to achieve the goal of the war. They both agree, and here we have to state that. Both Biden and Netanyahu agree on the goal of the war, which is the destruction of Hamas. We always hear Biden speaking about the same goal of Netanyahu, but how to achieve this goal is where they both divert. Because Biden believes that the U.S. today has a historic chance to complete the normalization process through dragging Saudi Arabia towards a normalization deal with Israel. Also, that he has a historic chance to end the Palestinian case by establishing, an unarmed Palestinian state, which means a Palestinian state with no sovereignty. Netanyahu's strategies, his military strategies, his insistence of going into Rafah and continuing the military campaign threatens what the U.S. is trying to achieve, and threatens the U.S. strategies and This is what the US have been working years ago, from 2020, from the first normalization process when it starts till today. Netanyahu is threatening this whole process, and that's why these divisions occur. And it's only between Biden and Netanyahu, not between Israel as an entity.
But at the same time, we have upcoming moves that include milestones for both entities, such as the visit of Yoav Gallant, the Israeli entity war minister, to the Pentagon, and as well as discussions by Israeli entity delegations, which are agreed to be sent to Washington to discuss the last call that happened between Biden and Netanyahu concerning not going through with the invasion of Rafah. Why does that sound like the real deal there, like the real negotiations happening there, not in Qatar, not in the UNSC? This is how it sounds.
Yes, because as you have stated, I think that the negotiations in the US are of the same importance as those in Qatar, in Doha. The real negotiations also, as you stated, is in the US, because what's happening in the US is that the United States, is Biden's administration, trying to pull Netanyahu and his government, pull Israel out of a strategic defeat. The Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin had told the Israelis before, we are trying to, please don't change a tactical win to a strategic defeat. Negotiations in the US target to just give Israel this strategic win. Yeah. And that's why they are of much importance. If Israel abide by the American strategies, then pressure will de-escalate. But if it doesn't abide, if Netanyahu also insists on continuing with his own strategies, with his own military campaign, with entering into Rafah, then we will have an escalation between Biden, a political escalation between Biden and Netanyahu. That's why the negotiations in the US are really important. There are two things that may lead out of these negotiations. First, these negotiations will decide whether political pressure will increase between Biden and Netanyahu, and second, to what extent the war will continue, because the negotiation, what the US wants from these negotiations is to lead to a ceasefire inside Gaza. And this ceasefire, of course, isn't related to what the people on Gaza needs. It's serving the Israelis' interests as the US sees them. Whereas if these negotiations fail, then Netanyahu will proceed with his military campaign, and this threatens an escalation in the whole region. And that's why I think if negotiations in Qatar need to work, then they have to be achieved in the US first, and that's why they are of much importance.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Hassan Swaydan, a strategic studies researcher, writer for different media platforms, and author of several studies in the field of international relations, for being with us discussing this pressing issue, hoping for a ceasefire for our brothers and sisters in Gaza the way that they see fit. Thank you very much for your contribution. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to discuss an end of an era for Netanyahu.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Before the Al-Aqsa flood battle and the ensuing war of extermination launched by the Zionist Israeli occupation army, and during the battle, the tendency of most analysts, commentators, and observers focused on the role of the extremist Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his dangerous and harmful policies. So much so that it seemed to many that removing him as leader of a racist right-wing regime in this entity would open the doors to finding a political solution to the war of extermination in Gaza and the West Bank. But is this true, though? More details in the following report.
Can Benjamin Netanyahu emerge victorious from the genocidal war he is currently waging on the Gaza Strip? I believe he genuinely thinks so, and he seems convinced that the objectives he has set for this war are not only realistic, but also achievable. This explains his stubborn insistence on rejecting a ceasefire before his occupation army manages to retrieve all the captives held in the Strip, destroy the military infrastructure of Hamas, topple its rule in the area, and install an alternative authority willing to cooperate with the Zionist entity on security matters, with its primary mission being the protection of this entity from any resistance retaliations in the future. Many observers and officials have hinted repeatedly that getting rid of Netanyahu is step one to finding a political solution to the genocidal war in Gaza and the West Bank, perhaps even to open up prospects for an acceptable and reasonable settlement in a prisoner exchange deal between resistance movements in Gaza and the Israeli entity. Western media outlets, along with statements from some Western officials, such as the European Union's Foreign Minister Joseph Borrell, and his statements opposing Netanyahu's obstinacy, have fueled this inclination among some. The truth is that this kind of analysis and commentary diverts attention from the reality of this racist entity in its body, mind, and spirit. Especially after tens of millions of free people from all corners of the earth demonstrated their support for the Palestinian cause overall, protesting for over 5 months or more in all Western, African, Asian, European, and Latin American cities and capitals against the scale of crime and brutality perpetrated by Zionist Israel through all its political, military, and media institutions, especially in the Gaza Strip. This trend represents a misguided direction and a deviated compass from the essence and reality of the Israeli occupation's political structure, which began its history before 1948 with massacres and crimes, and continued as such throughout 75 years of the Arab-Zionist conflict. The truth is that this statement overlooks a set of fundamental historic and current realities, such as, firstly, neglecting without awareness the reality and essence of the natural origins of this entity and its crimes. Secondly, ignoring the demographic and ideological qualitative shift that has occurred during the past 40 years. Thirdly, overlooking the transformation in the political and party structure within the Israeli entity itself. And this superior approach persisted in every attack and aggression carried out by Israeli occupation forces against Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. Massacres and civilian killings were repeated in all these cases, totaling more than 1,200 invasion, aggression, and massacre incidents against neighbors since 1947 until the eve of the current aggression on Gaza since October 8, 2023, during which, in just 160 days, over 2,300 massacres were committed, resulting in more than 35,000 Palestinian martyrs, in addition to 71,000 wounded. The Israeli Zionists considered these massacres against Arabs, including Palestinians, as one of the pillars of the Israeli entity deterrence theory. Through a policy of terror and intimidation, the dream of building this Hebrew state is realized.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs. A pleasure for having you with us, Mr. Hassan. Now, Netanyahu faces an inescapable dilemma. His government is threatened with collapse whether it accepts or rejects any formula proposed by the resistance in Palestine. Consequently, early elections in Zionist Israel are highly likely at the moment in the upcoming months, which will inevitably lead to Netanyahu's disappearance from all the Zionist political scene. But is that enough to demote the risk on Gaza and the West Bank, or is the problem not only Netanyahu and his coalition?
Benjamin Netanyahu undoubtedly plays a fundamental role at this level in prolonging the war. This issue is a fundamental issue and a crucial knot in not stopping this battle. Netanyahu's staying in power is intertwined with the continuation of the fighting. If things head towards early elections and Netanyahu is forced out of power through the ballot boxes, this issue may affect the shape and course of the battle. Netanyahu is leading a battle for his political life at this level, and he fully realizes that the end of the war will lead him to be held accountable and tried. This issue will have decisive repercussions on his fate and his political trajectory. From this perspective, undoubtedly, early elections, if held during the war, will have significant implications at this level. Even though the other leaders still adhere to the issue of the battle's objectives and the elimination of Hamas, and they may align with the direction supported by the American administration regarding the exit from the war and the search for political solutions through agreement with the Palestinians on a formula for the next phase of the war. This is what Netanyahu currently rejects. From this perspective, Netanyahu may play a fundamental and decisive role at this level, whereby the issue of the battle's continuation is linked to his staying in power, while if he leaves this authority, alternatives and formulas may already be found through which the new authority can find ways to end the war and claim that it has achieved at least part of the objectives and goals it was seeking.
But this puts it at a very important question, which is one of the leading Zionist national security theories, which has always been to implement massacres in the arenas of their enemies and their adversaries, especially among civilians, in order to instill the element of terror, of being intimidated in the mind and consciousness of the people that they are fighting. They have succeeded in doing so, sadly, with an unprecedented scale of genocide in Gaza over the past 6 months, but do you think that this is what is considered a success inside of the Zionist entity community, if I may, despite the fact that they know that the objectives set by the regime were never met?
This issue relates to what the occupation terms deterrence in Zionist military theory, which dictates causing comprehensive destruction and notifying the other party that it will pay unbearable prices and cannot coexist with it if it chooses to confront the Zionist entity. From this perspective, the occupation sought to commit this enormous level of massacres and this high level of killing, destruction, and displacement of the Palestinian people. However, at this level, the occupation may have collided, despite the horror of the scenes in terms of human losses and destruction in Palestinian buildings and infrastructure. It collided with a state of resilience, endurance, and patience that the Palestinian people demonstrated in the face of this massive and terrifying massacre. From this perspective, Palestinians managed to cope with this level of fighting, and the matter was extremely painful, but their resilience on the ground, enduring the environment, and the resistance fighters' resilience prevented the occupation from achieving what the Zionist entity and Benjamin Netanyahu specifically called a decisive and final victory. Netanyahu has set a fundamental condition that cannot be achieved in any way, even in the view of various circles within the occupation entity, because he will not be able to eliminate Palestinian resistance, which continues to fight on all fronts despite 6 months passing since the battle. This issue confirms that the Zionist strategy has failed and that the theory of victory that Benjamin Netanyahu talks about will remain distant, and that the Palestinians have a long breath to continue fighting and are willing to make more sacrifices, and they will not raise the white flag, as many Zionist experts claim. This confirms that the occupation will not dream or taste the sweetness of victory in facing the Palestinians, but will encounter resistance in its various forms everywhere. We must take, for example, what happened in Al-Shifa Hospital after the occupation entered it in the previous period and claimed to have ended its work there. Now, it returns to this place to face persistent resistance and relentless fighting, indicating that the military operations, in the manner pursued by the occupation and utilizing all military capabilities and energies at its disposal, did not achieve its objectives, and that the victory Netanyahu talks about will be very distant.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is worth noting here that Benjamin Netanyahu has remained throughout his years in power since 1993, working and maneuvering to achieve two main goals for the Zionist entity. One, completely liquidating the Palestinian cause, and two, integrating Zionist Israel with the region by normalization at the same time, doing both goals at the same time. He always believed, and he still, by the way, believes that he could do that, that he is the only one capable of actually achieving those two goals. However, after Gaza 2023-2024, what do you think the legacy of Netanyahu will be after he gets either ousted or removed from power?
The reality of the normalization project, sponsored by the administrations of former President Donald Trump and current President Joe Biden, aligns perfectly with Benjamin Netanyahu's vision, who seeks to gain relations with Arab states in the surrounding region and the Gulf. But at the same time, he does not want to offer anything to the Palestinians. Netanyahu clearly adopted this theory and stated that we will go for settlement and normalization with the Arabs, leaving the Palestinians behind so that they eventually have no choice but to follow us and accept the conditions we offer. Netanyahu's theory now clearly states that he does not want to recognize any form of authority for the Palestinians or any form of sovereignty over any geographic area, neither in the West Bank nor in Gaza. yet he aspires to continue the path of normalization with the Arabs. This issue will remain on the table in the future stage. Some Arab parties, led by Saudi Arabia, have expressed their rejection of this principle and stated that they will not accept normalization unless the Palestinians obtain something. This issue cannot be accepted by the Arab public opinion in any way that fully harmonizes with Netanyahu's direction at this level. Netanyahu may have put the occupation and this entity on this path into crisis in the next stage because the level of confrontation that generated this kind of crime and Zionist destruction and this image of this entity at the level of Arab and Islamic public opinion will create a significant obstacle for any Arab state that may resort to normalization. After this massive massacre, it might be difficult at this level unless a power within the occupation entity accepts making concessions. However, it seems that we are now seeing the political level moving towards more right-wing extremism and racism, as the Knesset rejected recognizing any form of Palestinian state last month. This confirms that Benjamin Netanyahu has left extremist marks on Zionist policy that will not serve the occupation in the long run, but rather increase its isolation and prevent it from achieving what is called integration at the regional level.
Well, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs, I want to thank you very much for your time and contribution discussing with us an end of an era for a war criminal, a genocidal war criminal like Benjamin Netanyahu. Thank you for your time and effort, ladies and gents. Thank you. Please stay tuned as we bring you the latest from West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the United States, the Border Patrol chief has warned the migrant crisis is a national security threat and says his biggest fear is not the 1 million people apprehended so far this year, but the 140,000 known gotaways. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has called the situation at the southern border with Mexico a national security threat, expressing concern about tens of thousands of migrants who have evaded apprehension and entered the United States surreptitiously over the past 5 months. Jason Owens said Border Patrol is closing in on recording 1 million apprehensions of migrants in between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border in the 2024 fiscal year, which started last October. For the third consecutive year, his agency is on track to record 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends at the end of September, Owens said. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. But Owens asked, why are they risking their lives and crossing in areas where we can't get to? Why are they hiding? What do they have to hide? And what are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things, for us, are what represent the threat to our communities. The situation, Owens added, amounts to a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, added, and if we don't know who is coming into our country and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat, and are exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. However, Owens agreed that the vast majority of migrants coming into the United States border are good people. I think the migrants that we encounter that are turning themselves in, yes, I think they absolutely are, by and large, good people. I wish they would choose the right way to come into our country and not start off on the wrong foot by breaking our laws. While a very small amount of these apprehended at the southern border are serious criminals, such as those convicted of murder or other serious crimes, Owen said most migrants are surrendering themselves to Border Patrol agents to escape poverty or violence in their home countries. They're coming across because they're either fleeing terrible conditions or they're economic migrants looking for a better way of life, he said. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP statistics show a tiny fraction of migrants processed by Border Patrol have criminal records in the United States or other countries that share information with American officials. And an even smaller percentage have been convicted of serious crimes. Available data and studies also suggest that migrants in the United States illegally do not commit crimes at a higher rate than native-born Americans. Still, top law enforcement officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, have voiced concerns about criminal actors, including potential terrorists, exploiting the unprecedented levels of migration along the U.S. southern border with Mexico over the past 3 years. In both fiscal years, 2022 and 2023, Border Patrol reported over 2 million apprehensions of migrants who crossed the southern border illegally, both all-time highs. Jason Owen said the extraordinary flow of people into the United States is mainly driven by cartels. Asked if cartels were setting the rules of engagement at the southern border, Owen said, yes, they absolutely are. The New York Post has also covered this same story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owen said the migrant crisis has become a serious national security threat, as terrorists may be slipping across the border with Mexico and smugglers dictate the flow into the United States. They dictate what the flow is going to look like, and we respond to it, Owen said in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday. He said, we try and get out in front of it and deny them the ability to use these areas. But at the end of the day, there's over 1,900 miles of border with Mexico. Under the Biden administration, the United States has endured record levels of migrants pouring across the southern border with Mexico, including thousands who claim asylum and are then released into the country. Border Patrol has reported 1,151,000 encounters at the southern border, according to the most recent tally of numbers through the 2024 fiscal year. The prior year saw 2,475,000 cases, according to the agency. Owens fretted that there could be terrorists and other dangerous people slipping through the system. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. It's not part of that, he said, referring to the official count, and that's just what we know. That is a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, and if we don't know who is coming into our country, and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat. They're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. The border chief noted that most of the encounters are with individuals who are turning themselves in and are fleeing dire economic conditions at home. That doesn't make them bad people, it's just that they're not being respectful of the laws that we've established as a country, he said. Jason Owen stressed that there are dangerous people buried in that population that do pose a risk to the United States. The British newspaper, the Daily Mail, has also covered the same story. The US Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has said the crisis at the southern border with Mexico is a national security threat that keeps him awake at night, in a new interview during which he spelled out the danger posed by millions of illegal migrants who've entered the country in recent years. The US Border Patrol is mere days away from hitting 1 million apprehensions of migrants in fiscal year 2024, which began for the US government last October. What's keeping me at night awake is the 140,000 gotaways, Owen said. The number of migrants who have sneaked into the country undetected since last October. But he asked, what are they hiding? What do they have to hide? What are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? Owens explained are the primary concerns of the US Border Patrol about the gotaways, whose backgrounds and locations are virtually unknown to the US government. We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things for us are what represent a threat to our communities, he said. Jason Owens said his department is on track to record some 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends in September. The US Border Patrol chief said border security is a big piece of national security, and the illegal migrants being smuggled into the country are exploiting a vulnerability facing the nation at present time. He said migrants who've made their way into the United States this year have come from at least 160 different countries, some of which are many continents away. Routes from Europe and Asia lead to the Darien Gap in Panama, a popular starting point for smugglers leading large groups of migrants north through Central America and eventually into the United States.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting, according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Let me start off this episode with this question, Sheikh. Since we think that taking tablets or pills for treatment is not regarded as eating or drinking, or as you mentioned in one of the earlier programs, as a supplement, for example, in the common view, would taking those pills and tablets void the fast?
It definitely impacts the fast. It affects the fast. because taking tablets through the mouth is a kind of eating, though in common view it is not considered eating, but it is a kind of taking. Just as you take food, you also take pills. And taking tablets through the mouth does invalidate the fast.
Mm. During the month of Ramadan, husband or a man had sexual intercourse with his wife, with her consent. What's the rule concerning this?
Well, having sexual intercourse during the month of Ramadan is one of the invalidating agents, and it's strictly forbidden for a man and his wife to engage in sexual activities which result in, for example, in ejaculation, or, for example, having the intercourse itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it is forbidden. And if both of them engage in a consensual sexual activity and it results to having sex or ejaculation, the fast becomes void.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be necessary for both parties for both the individuals to give the qadha of their fast and also give a penalty, which is called in legal parlance. It is called actually kafara. So they have to give kafara, which is, you know, to fast for 60 days and feed 60 people, because if they do it deliberately, this kafara becomes payable.
Mm.
And of course, not only kafara, but also they have to give the qadha of the fast as well.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's have a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program. I just wanted to have you a question quite related to this, but let's leave it after the break. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulubana bil Qur'an.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program. Anshar Chowdhury, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Chowdhury, before the break, I asked you a question regarding sexual intercourse, which you said that, well, obviously it requires a penalty.
Yeah,
right?
Qadha and kafara.
And Qadha, yes, both actually. But what if the couple have a foreplay, basically, all right,
yes,
before their sex, and without, they don't come to the orgasm or the ejaculation of the semen in the month of Ramadan while they are fasting? Does this invalidate their fasting?
Well, foreplay in and of itself does not make the fast void, as long as the both of them are confident that it will not result in ejaculation. You know, there are many other sexual activities like kissing, hugging, and, you know, touching each other actually. All of these practices are allowed. As long as they are confident that these acts of sexual activity do not lead to some kind of orgasm or some kind of ejaculation for both parties, so the fast will not be rendered void.
I see. You, Tom, talked about the invalidating agent for fast. Would you tell us about the all of those invalidating agents? What does invalidate fast?
Yeah, there are a number of things which invalidate the fast. And of course, there are 9 things,
mm-hmm,
which invalidate the fast. One of them is eating, the other one is drinking, and then the sexual intercourse is strictly forbidden. It is also one of the invalidating agents. We discussed it. And then an act that causes semen to come out, like, for example, masturbation, which is a grave sin, it is strictly forbidden. And inshallah, maybe if we make time, we will discuss it.
Mm.
And then each of these invalidating agents that we I just enumerate here will have their own, has its own details and you see conditions which can be discussed in another episode, inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
And then failing to make ghusl for menses, for janaba, for nifas until the morning adhan. You know,
mm-hmm.
if a woman is in the state of janaba or in the state of monthly period or maybe in nifas, and she deliberately delays the you know, the ghusl which is required to be performed before dawn, so it's also one of the invalidating agents. And then enema, which is to insert some kind of liquid into the rectum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I should say also that, for example, if someone insert something hot, like something, for example, let's give the example of suppository.
Mm-hmm.
If it is inserted in the rectum because of the temperature, some people might have high temperature,
mm-hmm.
so it is sometimes becomes necessary. That will not affect the fast. But if liquid is inserted through the anus, it will definitely make the fast void. So this was enema was the fifth one, and then the sixth one is vomiting. If a person deliberately throws up and vomits something which is in his stomach, then it will make the fast void. Number seven, to tell a lie regarding God and Prophet and the infallible Imams as an obligatory precaution, to ascribe something lie. Ascribe or tell some a lie
mm-hmm.
regarding God, okay? It will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. His Eminence exercises precaution in this regard.
Mm. This was Prophet and Imams.
The Prophet and the infallible Imams, and of course God. Okay, if you said something that God said and said such and such thing, well, God never said that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you ascribe something false to God, well, God never said that, okay? If the fast becomes void. The same is the case with the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and also the infallible Imams and Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullahi alayha. If you ascribe something false to them, the fast becomes void as an obligatory precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So number eight.
Let's leave it up to the after the break. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back, continue our program and continue the invalidating agents of fasting after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting in general, and in particular, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the invalidating agents.
Yeah, we were talking about ascribing false things to God, the Prophet, infallible Imams, and as I said, based on the fatwa of all the religious authorities, ascribing false things to those noble figures, the Prophet and the Imams, and also God, and the Lord of the creation,
mm-hmm.
Is not permissible under any circumstances. It will affect the fast as an obligatory precaution. Now, the eighth one is allowing thick dust to reach the throat.
Yes.
For example, if you know there is dust somewhere, for example, in a room, and you enter that room, it's so dusty that you cannot see things. It's thick dust.
Yes.
And when it comes to thick dust, you should see what the common people consider the dust as thick. Mm-hmm. If in common view it's called, it is something is called as thick dust,
yes,
then it becomes an invalidating agent, and this again is based on obligatory precaution. So it, for example, smoking also comes under the very category because it's a kind of, let's say, dust. It's not dust, mm-hmm, but it's smoke, yes, going into something. It is something like dust, but it goes into your throat without you wanting to inhale it.
Yes.
So it is not permissible, and it will make the fast white as an obligatory precaution. Then there is the ninth thing, which is submerging the whole head under water. Submerging the head under water. We know that submerging means that you, for example, jump into the water, for example, a lake or a swimming pool, and all of your body is covered by water. You submerge and you immerse your head underwater. This immersion is not permissible while fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether you are fasting, you are observing a wajib fast or a mustahab fast. It definitely makes your fast wide according to His Eminence, according to some of the religious authorities. There are, I said, this is a matter of dispute and controversy.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars, including, for example, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, is of the view that submerging your head underwater, it does not affect your fast. So it's permissible to swim in the month of Ramadan and to dive underwater in the month of Ramadan, according to him. But according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, one should avoid submerging. So, of course, swimming is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And pouring water on your head is permissible. It does not affect, because normally when you pour water on your head, it does not make your fast void.
Mm-hmm.
You can pour your water on your head, and it's in common view, it's not considered to be submerging your head under water. If you want to stand under a waterfall, again, it's not considered to be a kind of immersion underwater.
Yes.
You just like you stand under a fountain, let's say the shower, you go and take a shower and the water comes on your head.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's not considered to be submersion in the common view.
I see.
So ghusl, and of course, the fast is not made void.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. And on behalf of the rest of the crew, we wish you farewell and ask you to keep us in your du'as and remember us in this blessed month, Ramadan. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iransat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the death toll from the Israeli genocide in Gaza exceeds 32,600 as the regime's indiscriminate strikes claim more Palestinian lives. Thousands of Iranians hold rallies across the country in